What's up, everybody? It's Keith from the Stream Team. With me, as always, Chris and Cole. And tonight, we're going to the second movie in the Indiana Jones series, The Temple of Doom. We find ourselves in India for this one. Not literally, but we're in India. And this is actually an interesting movie. So this comes 3 years after the original. But even though it's the sequel, it plays as a prequel. This was set in 1935, and Raiders was set in 1936. So this is actually a prequel to the first, to Raiders, even though Raiders came out first. But we are 1984, another Steven Spielberg movie, another movie rated PG.
Yeah. Can't believe that one. Yeah.
I have no idea. This one is like way darker. Like this one has like more gruesome and grisly, especially for the time. I have no idea how this one's rated PG. That's nuts.
This movie takes a sharp turn once we get to Pangkok Palace.
Yeah, and buddy.
We'll talk about that. The whole mood of the movie just changed dramatically once we got to Pangkok, especially after the dinner. But again, we'll talk about that. Directed by Steven Spielberg again. Another movie under 2 hours, 1 hour, 59 minutes. Steven Spielberg was like, listen, go in the theater, have a good time, and you can still go home and grab or get out of there and grab something to eat if you guys want to do that. I'm not going to keep you all night. He was like, we're going to keep this sucker tight. And it actually flowed pretty well, too. I don't think
I'm
just like
to talk itch.
Yeah.
I don't really have to make a movie. I'm just trying to talk itch.
I'm just trying to talk at you.
I think you can call me. It's going to be a movie. Good men are dead. Good men are dead.
But another lesson. Sub 2 hour movie. We are in India again. We find ourselves kind of all over the map again. We start out, we're in Shanghai, and then we're flying back home, and all of a sudden we have a plane crash, which that scene is actually really, I forgot how funny all of that was. Willie wakes up Indiana and just like an empty plane with a bunch of chicken feathers flying around. Hilarious. Yeah. But the Rotten Tomato score 77-82. The budget was $28 million. We did 300.
Sure was.
Yeah, sure 28 was. Million, man. Steven was just like, pay me my money.
Pay me my money.
In cash.
A little extra
in cash.
Cash.
This is still like, and I know $28 million was like $270 million back then, probably, especially if you have a guy as smart as him. But like, this movie looks, you know, it looks like they got a lot done with $28 million.
Oh, still. Yeah, sure.
Last bit of work. I didn't know that was the budget on that one. I can't wait to find out the budget.
They packed this motherfucker out.
Oh yeah, so, yeah. This one did a little bit less than the first one. Well, and I feel like he's, you know, Spielberg may be like a bargain shopper or something. Like, dude has just like a wallet full of coupons or something. Because like again, you got $10 million more in this one. He did $333 million. The first one did $389 million. So a little bit less than Raiders, but still did well for 1984, but he made look, and there was a couple of scenes. Listen, like it was obvious that they weren't where they were, and that's fine. I mean, I know the first one it was a little bit more seamless, but I think the practicality of the first one made that look better. Where in this one, we're on the side of mountains and we're jumping out of airplanes and we're, you know, in a life raft after the airplane has crashed. So there's a couple of more difficult things that need to be done, but it's still overall obviously a good movie. But we get an addition with Short Round, which, man, I forgot how good Ki-Hoo Kwan was in this one. A Short Round, like, you know, of course we get him in Goonies. I think it's the next year. Yeah, 85, he's in the Goonies. But man, he was, which for his film debut, this kid was cooking, man. Like,
oh yeah. He had some shit to do, man.
He had a lot. No, it was more than something, though. He was in there like, he was like, if we got a best supporting with him, and I know he ends up getting into everything everywhere all at once, but bro, like, I mean, put that kid in for best supporting because he was in there absolutely cooking. Like, there are several scenes where he was toe-to-toe with Indiana, man, and I'm just like,
oh, for sure, yeah.
Did he cook Indiana in the scene? Like, what are we doing here? Which, and I think it's a bigger deal in 84 because I don't know that there's going to be a lot of writing for anybody other than our main guy to really have an opportunity to show, you know, to be the focal point in the shot. So for him to really steal the attention from almost every scene he's in, I think is just a monumental feat. But we'll talk about him. But a cast, again, we have Harrison Ford, Kate Capshaw as Willie Scott, We have a variety of other people. I want to name one, but he's actually my Mustang, so I'm going to leave him out until we get to the categories. But we are, again, so we're set, starting out in Shanghai. And again, man, just Spielberg starts this movie with a bang. Like, he knows how to open a movie, you know, like we're in the club and we got that we have the diamond and we have the remains of the first emperor of Shanghai. I mean, it's just all these things are happening at once. We have Indiana Jones and his guys. We have Willie showing up and she's performing. Cole, talk about opening the movie with a bang. How great was this opening, especially coming off how good the opening was in Raiders?
Yeah, and I think, like, it's, you know, I can always bring something back to James Bond, right? But this most Bond-like opening I think I've seen in a really long time, right? And I mean that in the best possible way.
Yep.
Yeah, because Spielberg, you know, obviously he loves movies. And you could tell, like, that was in, you know, every great director wants to make a Bond movie, and usually they end up making a Bond scene. This was definitely his Bond scene. I mean, even down to the dress, down to the exchange, down to all the different fancy shit going on all at the same time. Like, one of my favorite parts of this whole movie is the beginning, actually, it's like, not only does he do all that kind of cool stuff, he has this bizarre musical number in there for, like, no apparent reason whatsoever, just to prove that he can do it. You know what I mean? Why does there need to be a 16-person dance scene? I don't fucking know, but let's go, right? And then we get all of the other kind of cool shit that we know and love from, you know, from the Indiana Jones character, like his charm, his kind of grittiness, like his willingness to use anybody, right? Like, he was going to stab her with a fucking fork. Like, he just has that kind of thing. And that whole scene is, like you said, Keith, like, it sets the stage and is one of the few scenes that we have that he's not, like, in his normal element of, like, the adventure in the woods or in the desert or whatever it is. Like, he's in a city. Yep. And I don't remember in the other two a lot of that. Like, there was in Cairo in the first one, of course, but this is a little bit different, right? They're driving cars to the town. They're having, like, there's a legit car chase. Yep. And so I think that is one thing that makes it particularly cool. It's like, I don't know that it belongs in Indiana Jones movies, but it's fucking awesome, right?
It's
like,
awesome.
It's like, there aren't other scenes like this in the series. And it's like, let's fucking go. Mainline that shit.
Oh, dude, 100%. I mean, just like you said, just the way it's set up, Indiana looks completely different. Like, it's almost like, who is this guy? But in a good way, again, like you said, in the best possible way, Cole. Like, everything about that opening scene was phenomenal. I mean, we've got poison in the drink. You know, he gets a drink, and, like, just like in Bond fashion, like, he celebrates his victory or he celebrates the end of a mission by having a drink, right? You know, so there's just things. We got the champagne popping, and then we get, like, the gunshot while the champagne is popping too. We get all that stuff, and then we get that just a really cool, funny scene where, like, the diamond's getting kicked around, but so is the antidote. Right. And then, like, we're chasing after that, and then we have, like, Indiana behind a giant gong with the automatic weapons. It's just, everything is just going sideways, but it's great. And I think that it was just a testament to just good movie maker from Spielberg, and really, like you said, opening the movie with a bang, but then also injecting some comedy in there too. I think that we see
very funny
a lot more. It was. And I know that Kate Capshaw's Willie played a giant part in that, just because she was the screaming damsel in distress, which apparently she screamed 71 times in this movie, and it feels like it.
Not surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but I think just Harrison Ford's comedic timing in that really played very well, and the jokes he had to land and the timing of it, and given the severity of the scene, it goes off very well. Chris, again, I know we're and it's still something I have to process, but we're still early in your Indiana Jones career, so this being one of your earlier viewings of it, just talk about the opening of this, and then just, again, now that you have a little bit of history with Indiana, seeing how this movie opens in comparison to the first one.
It's still, like, a really good opening. It's another one of those things where it's like, as far as the musical number goes and some of the other stuff with Harrison Ford actually, and I've seen it before. Like, I've seen it in, like, clips and in other montages, and I just certainly didn't know that this was from Indiana Jones. I mean, some of the stuff from the first one I could tell was, like, oh, it's Indiana Jones because he's got the hat on. But, like, the musical number here, like Cole said, it's kind of just, like, random flexing from him. And I was like, oh, okay, this must be from a fucking like a just a classical, you know, musical film, and I just, it's another one I haven't seen. So to see it and see it start that way, I was like, oh, this is from an Indiana Jones movie. That is funny. Like that's what made it the funniest thing to me, like just like the musical number in and of itself. Because again, I would have never predicted that it would have started with one. And again, it's not just like something that's thrown in there to be in the background. The camera's like hard stuck on it for the first, what, 2-3 minutes? Like that's yes. The first 3 minutes of the movie, and it's yeah. really good. So I enjoyed that. And then to go to the scene again where Indiana Jones comes in and he's got the suit on, it's another one of those things where it's just like seeing him even outside of the traditional, like the iconic costume, but still knowing it's him. It's still just the coolest guy on earth showing up. And it was a lot of Bond. And I think that makes more sense. Like that's the vibe that I was getting. I just couldn't put my finger on it. So you're right, Blake. It felt like a, like, you know, almost like a Bond opening scene, like that little that opening mission that they'll have in a Bond movie. Like it felt like it could have been one of those little one shots. And it was funny and like interesting in a way that I really enjoyed it. I think it got to do some stuff that maybe like the first one just couldn't do because of just the setting, right? Like we, you know, when you think, when I thought about this guy, of course, I thought about being in the jungle, being in a temple, like being in a place like that. Like, I didn't really have any strong thoughts of him in like a more modern, normal day-to-day setting and how
like a nightclub, right?
Yeah. And get around and do what he does in those. Yeah, so see, like I would have never been like, you know, there's a scene with Indiana Jones in a nightclub. I'm like, you're lying. He would never go to one of those. He just goes to the jungle. He goes to work.
It's an ancient nightclub.
Like, that's a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Detroit, like, I'm confused. Like, what is nightclub code for? Is it like, it's like an acronym? So,
yeah. Right. Is it an old Egyptian?
Like, exactly. It's like, it's weird for a movie that's, what, coming up on about 40 years old.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird to see him in a quote unquote modern setting. Obviously, it's saying that it's even older because it said what you said 1930 or whatever. So it's like 35. The setting he's in is almost 100 years, you know, out of time. But like, you know, again, my exposure to him, my thoughts of him were just being in temples and old ruins and stuff. So seeing him in a situation like that was funny. And like, we'll get into if that makes this entire movie really funny for me. Like he just like keeps engaging with like modern technology for the time and bad things keep happening. So like my take was like, maybe he shouldn't, you know, he shouldn't engage in the technology of his time. He should just go to things that are 100 years old. Cause you know, he got an airplane and look what happened to him, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
that was hilarious too.
Plane, you know,
it was so funny. He's like, see you later, Lao She. And he like closes the door and it's like, Lao She.
Yeah.
But it is just like you said, it's just a very fun like opening from all of that, from the club scene to the escape. I mean, they have to jump down and they're like, you know, ripping through canopies, and then they get in the car and we have Short Round on the as the wheel man getting out of there, you know, and it, which is just also hilarious too, like him driving. He has
the blocks tied to his shoes
on his feet. Yeah.
Good
but he
touch.
Was whipping though, man. He was getting
he was getting after it
with tight turns. So I think, you know, immediately having him introduced, I mean, he played a large role in this. It wasn't just like he was the sidekick. I mean, I know this is kind of a Batman and Robin scenario, but man, he was borderline Batman himself for a couple of scenes. But we have the introduction.
I'm Batman.
Yeah. I'm counting on it.
I'm Batman.
I'm Michael Keaton. I'm Batman.
I'm Batman.
I'm Batman. But introduce the Kihu Kwan in this movie, Cole. This and is an interesting, I think, touch to have a sidekick, I guess, so to speak, for Indiana, because obviously it's not Indiana and Short Round, it's Indiana Jones. So for him to be there immediately, and again, this is what we talked about when we talked about Raiders, how good of a delegator Indiana Jones is, from, you know, having the guy helping him in the nightclub to having Short Round driving him out of there, you know, like he knows what he's good at and he knows what others are good at, and he utilizes those people in the best possible way. Let's just talk about Kihu Kwan's performance in this and just how awesome he was going toe to toe with arguably the hottest actor of that time.
Yeah, I mean, it's an impossible act, right? Like, it's, yeah. I don't know how exactly you pulled pull that off. Yeah, exactly. Like, that would be a shitty situation if you're fucking Daniel Day-Lewis, right? Like, you're, and what I like most about it is it doesn't, like, it's a bizarre choice to put a kid in it because it could go so horribly bad. But obviously, Steven Spielberg knew exactly what he had in Kiwiquan, and it was something that no matter how much was thrown at him, he kept making it happen, right? Like, it was like, okay, well, now you've got to do this. Okay, cool. I'll do it. Now you got to do this. You got to be in this scene with, you know, two very good actors. Like, good luck. And he always seemed to figure out a way to, like, have that charisma and kind of, like, that charm that Indy himself has, even though he was, like, a very young kid and that was kind of, like, the point of it. Yeah, I mean, I think he was just sensational, man. And it's, like, it's, you know, obviously he's finally got his roses, but it was crazy, like, 3 years ago, having watched this movie, it's always like, wonder what happened to that guy. And I know he did some stuff, but, like, you know, it wasn't until recently that he really came back onto the scene, and good for him, because it, like, this was a performance, and I'm sure, like, you know, he was a child. So the trauma of being in a movie and trying to figure it all out and then go through an entire life of acting, trying to get back to where you started, right? Like, that's a pretty crazy thing. And he was just sensational, man. And it was fun to have the character because, like you said, Keith, it was something else for Indiana Jones to play off of. We had already got him with grown-ups in the first one, and his buddies, and we knew there was that. So they were trying to do something different. And I think it worked great because, he was very fun to watch. He was very funny and kind of added another element to the film that we hadn't necessarily seen in Raiders.
Right, and he did a phenomenal job. And I think it's interesting that you said that where Spielberg just, like, kept kind of throwing challenges at him, and it felt like he wasn't going to back down from any of them, because I feel like that was also, he was a victim of his own success, so to speak, where Spielberg may have seen him in a scene, he was like, okay, this is what you're going to do, maybe slow play him a little bit, and then Kwan was like, no, this is how it's going to go, and, you know, his volume's turned up to 10, but it's not, like, over the top, it's a good, just a well-acted scene by a talented actor, and then Spielberg was like, all right, well, then let's have you do this, okay. let's have you do that, yeah, right, it's like, let's cook, you know, with this kid, like, we've got something special in our hands, and he was utilized, I thought, very well in his role as Short Round. And so just having him in that particular character, I know we have talked about child actors a variety of times with a lot of the movies that we've had, and man, he's this performance. There were just certain times I just forgot, outside of just the volume of his voice, you know, like the pitch and the tone of his voice, I forgot that it was a child acting in this particular case, and it's not just, like, you know, a young teenager or even a young adult interacting with Indiana Jones over the course of it. But this is set, so, like, again, we start in Shanghai, we're getting a plane, and the pilots jump out, and then we crash land in India, and it's happens. No, man, it's same, like, how many times, Cole, have we talked about that, man. I feel like just I've lost count, honestly, but
yeah, it's fucking wild
having to jump out of the plane with no parachutes, and we get the life raft and that entire scene. But I did like the approach of how what is needing to be attained by Indiana, with the shaman invited them to the village and talk about the perils of it, and immediately, like, waiting for them by the riverside and letting them know, like, hey, I need you to go recover this stone for, like, that's something that he prayed for and he showed up. Chris, we'll talk about just their, you know, getting to the village, the interaction with the villagers and the shaman, and them being like, you're going to Pangkok Palace and you're going to get this stone for us because I prayed for help and you showed up. Let's just talk about that approach with the villagers, you know, missing their children, missing their sacred stone, and really thrusting Indy and the group into their particular mission.
Yeah, again, it's another one of those things where it's just like, I feel like so many of my answers, and I know you guys are influenced by me having no real experience with these movies or any part of it.
Yeah.
Like, this is another one of those things that's super influenced by my first time seeing this, right, and thinking it was going to go one way. Like, I didn't expect for Indiana Jones to stumble into adventures like this. Like, I thought everything that he did was super intentional. Like, he ends up somewhere because, in Raiders. Sorry, I'm choking on something. I think, I don't know. Just like in Raiders, like, he sets out specifically to go and get something. So to see this from, like, where they basically, like, the blunder that happens in the opening leads him here, right? Like, he gets that, mm-hmm. and then he has to take the plane and escape, and the plane goes down. You know, where it goes down, and the shaman comes out and sends him on the mission. I wasn't expecting for an Indiana Jones movie to have that. You know, I didn't think that he would just, like, walk out of a river, and a guy was like, hey, I need you to do a thing. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. That was kind of fun and interesting to me that it wasn't so coordinated. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like a super planned out thing. I know, like, all of his adventures, even when he does have a plan, obviously stuff is going to go awry, right? Because the line of work that he's in. But to see him really just be kind of found on his back foot and sent into this, it was just really, it was fun. Like, it was different. Again, it wasn't at all what I was expecting, where I thought that these movies would ever go. It was on the second one. But I did really like that. You know what I mean? I feel like most of the times when we get movies like this, they are always super planned out by the main character. Mm-hmm. Like, even like it wasn't funny, it's also just kind of funny to me that, like, he just happened to end up here. Another guy prayed for him, but it's just like, had the plane gone down an hour earlier, an hour later, like, this movie just doesn't happen. It's just a coincidence. Like,
had he just died of poison?
Yeah, I thought. Yeah, having just died, and you know, it was like the Han Solo Club or something like that. Mm. Hey, he just died, and this movie just doesn't happen. They don't get those rocks back. So, yeah, I thought that was good. But yeah, I think that's my favorite part about the whole thing. Of like, it just kind of happens to him. And again, he's Indiana Jones, so he makes it work. But it's just like, this is what I had on my docket for today.
Yeah. And so many times, Nicole, I'll throw this to you real quick. We'll talk about, especially with sequels, and I know this was positioned as a prequel, but, you know, running the same gag back, right, where it's just like almost like there's a, like the IMF, where somebody approaches him for a mission. In this case, it's not that, it's like the shaman, like he said, had prayed for him, and they show up in his village. So it's similar but different, right? And it gives it a different feel. Obviously, like we talked about, the movie is darker with the content in it, but it's not so much that he's approached by the government or another archaeologist or somebody like this. Like, he is, what they think is a coincidence ends up being their main goal in this movie.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because it's, you know, this is the one of the three that objectively didn't work as well as the others. Right. And I think that what's weird to me about it is that the things that worked extremely well in the first one, they kind of went in a different direction in this one. And I do like this one. That's not what I mean. But like in the first one, the part of him being a professor, the dialogue, the love story, that sort of stuff all played really well. And it's kind of like in this one, what they understood best was that people really liked action sequences, so they just loaded the motherfucker with them. They were just like, let's just do back to back to back to back to back, and let's just do action sequences and not really have a ton of heart. And of course, like, the storyline itself is a little dark, so it like has that kind of like bizarreness to it and almost mythicalness that like you wouldn't expect an Indiana Jones movie to have necessarily. Like, I know we had the cradle in the first one, or the Ark rather, and it, you know, it sucked all the souls out of everybody. But like, this one had something different to it where it kind of felt out of the Indiana Jones world. And I don't mean that like in necessarily a bad way. Because like, again, everything we get after this is a bit of a continuation of that sort of principle. But I guess like it's really cool to try something different. But I am like, I'm very curious how this one is the one that got made next, right? Because it's like, okay, cool. We're just going to go to India, film some stuff on scene, and we're going to do a bunch of fucking action sequences. And I'm very like curious how exactly that played out.
It feels like
this feels like such third movie in the trilogy syndrome, like this, because like you said, much of the stuff that makes the first one great is just gone. That's what's like, I enjoy the pivot to the mission just kind of stumbling
upon
them, but I was surprised that no one just handed it. And, you know, it's not like, okay, well, we've already done that one twice, you need to switch it up. It's like, we did it one time and it worked, let's back off of it now. Like, it's so weird that, like you said, Keith, you want to move on to the next gag, but it's like, in this, they didn't even do it long enough to realize that it was a gag. You know, it was like a thing that they did once. Right. You know, they sleep on it one time on accident before they realized it was really funny, and they're just like, let's fucking put a tomato down there next, I guess. So that was really strange to me too, like just how different this was. Like, I totally feel like this has a vibe of like there's supposed to be one between
right.
Raiders and this. Like,
so, and then they go back to the well for Last Crusade, right? And it works perfect. Yes. Like they do more of the professor
it's
stuff.
It's incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. And then they do a lot of the kind of stuff that made the first one so cool. And like, again, I think part of it was probably like, oh yeah, we get a big budget this time. I don't have to fucking tape together the set pieces anymore. And we're going to do a bunch of really cool shit. And it really, it felt like that a lot. Like Spielberg was just like, no, I'm just going to have fun with this one. And that's not like anything to scoff at. Like, we were talking about it last week with Roadhouse. It's like totally fine to just do something that's fun.
Yeah.
Right. And it just, to me,
like, I like this too. I've made it sound like I like it, but just to be sure, like, yeah, I did still really enjoy this. It just did feel so
it's fun,
weird,
it's fun
how
movie.
Different it was from the one, what, a year, 2 years, not a year, but like, what, how soon was the first one? 2 years before this?
This is 3 years, yeah, 81, 84.
Three?
Yeah,
okay, 81, 84. So, like, yeah, just 3 years ago, we just had this shit stamped down, and then in 84, they're like, what if. You just showed up to the boardroom. What if?
Yeah, we just crash landed. And I think what happened.
$28 million. What if?
Yeah. It felt like an analogy that we've made so many times where it's getting to the red zone and call a different play, right? Like, let's just go down. And I know that this is the second. So there is pressure to still be good, but not do the exact same thing. But Chris, just like you're saying, I think you played it perfectly. They didn't realize that same thing would still work. And I think at that time, too, there's just a lot of pressure to make another great movie. And it almost, to me, feels like the Ocean's trilogy where like 11 was incredible. 12 was good, but it was just like trying to do a little bit too much. And then 13, we got back to what worked and cooked with
roots.
The original. Yeah, cooked with the original recipe and everything was fine again. So I think that is just the case where Spielberg was just like, I want to make this movie great again. So let's try something a little bit different. Whereas people were just like, no, we like he may have been surprised at how many people were like, we like the historical aspect of it. We like him being the professor. We liked him talking about the artifacts and all these other different things, but we didn't get while he still had the knowledge of the stones and their power and all that. He just fell into this mission. And again, he was prayed for by the shaman to help recover the children and bring the village back to its feet. But at the same time, it's not like he had researched this particular village and he knew about the lineage and all the different things. So it's similar, but
he was kind of positioned as a superhero rather than a main character like he had been in the first one, where it's like you believe he's a badass, but this dude, like, now he's this magnanimous character that is almost like Christ-like in a way, where it's like, oh well, he's gonna be the person that delivers us from this. And he was kind of an asshole in the first one, right? Like, I don't know that it's weird because it's like, I don't know that Indiana Jones would have been righteous enough to do that in the first one. I wouldn't have guessed that, right? It's like, oh
yeah,
I know he's in it for the sake of the artifacts and historical stuff, but like, he totally abandoned what's her name. He's done, like, he isn't this like perfect character, and they kind of present him as that in this one, where he's more so like Tony Stark than he is like Indiana Jones. And it still works. Like, that's the thing. Like you said, Keith, they got to the red zone and they'd been running all game and they threw it. Somehow somebody caught it in the end zone and still scored.
Dude, yeah.
But it's still a weird choice.
It is, and it's odd too, especially with it being positioned as a prequel. And maybe that was a case where he was acting differently, and then when we got to Raiders, he was like, "Let me get my, you know, let me tone this down a bit." I don't know. Maybe that may have a point. You know, just like in the Bond series, like we're talking about with Casino Royale. You know, he's really a wild card in that one, and more. And I know that he's still a wild card in the rest of them, but by the time we get to Skyfall and the rest, he's more calculated with stuff. He was getting ass kicked in Casino Royale. He was just fucking up a lot. Whereas we get to Skyfall and Spectre, and while he has some very worthy adversaries, he's still a little bit more calculated this time around. But again, we still love the movies. They were incredible. This one still played really well. I think that having a darker force, and it's also odd to say a darker force, because in the first one he's fighting Nazis who have a cradle that could give them the power to and, you know, basically enslaved mankind. So to be like, yeah, it's darker than that, it's weird to say. But Chris, we'll talk about their adversaries in this one with the with what's going on in Pangkok Palace, of course, with the child labor. I mean, it's just like hit on top of hit. They've got child labor going on there, and they're making sacrifices to Shiva with the stones. We are, you know, they're making people drink the blood. Yeah, it's like there's so many different things that is going on that makes these people just really crappy. But we'll talk about their adversaries there.
Child slaves.
Yeah, the Maharaja as the he's, you know, a 12-year-old boy and all sort of stuff. But let's just talk about that and what they face as we get to Pangkok Palace.
Yeah, I mean, they still found a way. Obviously, like you, when we're talking about them changing stuff, it's like, well, what do we follow up like Nazis with? You know, you've got like you yeah. out there, you've yeah. got just like the
perfect solid point,
and like you don't have to do any heavy lifting. Just be like, oh, these guys are Nazis. Like, it doesn't even matter what their goal is. It's like Indiana Jones, it's a call and a drone strike. Oh my goodness. Like, that's such an easy layup. So it's like, you bring in these guys, and I think they maybe went about it the best way possible to kind of sell them. And, you know, I think there's some, like, some odd stuff going on with some of the characterization here, and, like, this being the choice. It certainly didn't seem like it seemed like it just had harmless intentions. They just needed bad guys for the movies. And I think the best thing that you can kind of do to sell them on being, I know you don't have to compare every part of this to the first movie, but like you have to be like, they're engaged in child slavery. You know what I mean? Like you have to
right, yeah, something yeah.
super evil to try to get people to root against in the same way as, you know, you root against the Nazis. And obviously, their enemies in the first one and in the last one that, you know, don't have super dark, shady stuff going on. You just kind of rooting in because, you know, they're the bad guys. But I think, like, again, to follow up the first one and think, like, well, we have to, you know, keep certain yeah, things that work.
Like one up Nazis.
Yeah.
It's yeah, it's like we need another group of people that are just so believably and unequivocally and, like, unquestionably evil. You know what I mean? Because it's almost like if you take away I'm afraid if you take away the child slave, you take away the child slave. They're okay.
Yeah, they're not.
All right.
Yeah, once right. we get
where's this out, going?
Yeah,
it's not even that bad.
See him laying this plane.
It's not that bad. But I'm like just having to say the sentence. If you take away the child slavery, I'm like that does not sound like it's going anywhere good ever. But they're obviously still very bad, but you know what I mean? Where, like, it makes them just seem more, these just like their tribalistic things and these are their, you know, they're more so their beliefs. And it's like the problem maybe just comes with the fact that they stole the stones from the group that already had it. But if you almost look at it and go, well, you know, how different are they than the other group? If they're just kind of falling back on, you know, the beliefs of the region and all that and how people feel about the stones. So it's like they kind of weirdly just had to take one specific thing that's just like an unequivocal evil to throw in there. And I think it still works. You know, like I said, there are other issues to have with that group. But, you know, it still works. I think it's easier to end up like hating even without the child slavery stuff. I have to stop saying that. The like the people when they go to the palace, like they just have more of like a smug evil feeling, like the guy in the suit. I'm like, oh yeah, he's just like, he's definitely the bad guy. Like it's something about, and I guess maybe you're kind of primed for that by what happens to Indiana Jones at the beginning. Yeah, I think they still, you know, like I said, it was kind of a rough thing to follow up in terms of like just kind of the henchmen and the minions to just bring about another just evil group. You know, it's kind of tough to follow up the Nazis with that. But, you know, like I said, they had to throw in they had to throw in the one thing they knew would get everyone on board. Because I don't think there's a scenario where people are like, oh, this one wasn't as good. The main group wasn't, what do you say, they weren't as evil. They weren't as compelling. You know what I mean? Like, they weren't all that bad, actually. They were misunderstood. Yeah. Like, I don't think that would be anyone's takeaway.
Yeah, they're like, I can deal with child slavery, but stealing stones crosses the line. It's like, no, I think it's all bad.
Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. it's all bad. And I think what makes this one, obviously they're doing a lot of bad shit, right? Like we're in the palace and we have the really
I hope it didn't make it sound like I was saying they're not too bad.
No, because they are. The dinner scene is the dinner scene is very interesting. And if you want to talk about that, we can. I'll let you talk about that because I know that's some cuisine you really like to dive into. But
Yeah.
I think what makes it especially
the snake within the snake is pretty that's pretty banging. Yeah.
That was in, like how did the snakes inside how did those not get cooked? Yeah. So just the outside was cooked, but the snakes inside were good?
I mean, I guess snakes are thick, man, you know.
Yeah. This very I'd like to talk to the chef. What's going on in that scene? I got two dead bodies.
I got two dead bodies inside of a snake. I'm sorry. The goddamn anaconda bread got overcooked.
I'm sorry.
Anaconda bread is crazy.
I'm sorry, you monkey brains.
Do you think those were flambéed? How was that dessert? That's what I want to know. I don't know much about monkey brains.
It was chilled like jello. Yeah. It was chilled monkey brain.
They chilled the brains down. But are brains sweet or something? Like, where do you get your... Maybe they like drizzled them in with honey and then flambéed.
I think there was a little bit of food coloring and a little bit of probably some whipped cream or something added on there. You know,
Jesus. Yeah.
You ever have like a fruit dip and like fruit with a fruit dip in it? I think that was on like that fluff or whatever it's called. Yeah,
I got you. So you think after you got underneath the brains, there was like raspberry bites or something?
Yeah, there was. Yeah,
it was like there a parfait.
There were some peaches in there, some peach bits.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I could maybe swing that then. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's not so. It's still vegan too, though. So you're good. Even though it is monkey brains, like it's still. So, yeah. Can I get the chilled the vegan option?
Yeah. They bring out chilled monkey brain.
There's a guy I don't eat anything to tell you how nutrient dense it is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I bet you get some protein, that motherfucker.
Oh, no doubt. If anybody's macros are messed up after
crazy
that,
like, zinc in there.
Yeah.
Oh, zinc hurts my stomach, so I can't eat it.
Yeah, he can't do it. That's his big bugaboo, man. That and pepperoni pizza.
Nah, fuck.
But I think obviously being scared of the Malu Ram, what's his name? Mola Ram. As he is, it's like I said, there's a very sharp left turn this movie makes post dinner, after we go exploring through the palace, and that particular scene was also hilarious, where Indy's like calling out to Willie, and he's like, "We are going to die." He's like, "There's dead people out here." He's like, "There's about to be two dead people in here."
Yeah,
but having Indy turned on them too, I feel like was extra scary. Like it was weird, even though I was scared of the guy who obviously pulled somebody's heart out and then sacrificed him in the molten lava pit. After he made Indy drink the blood,
like, what is a chess move?
Was you crying when your heart was ripped out?
God damn it! I was gonna do it later. Fuck.
But Cole, having Indiana Jones turned on his crew for a little bit. I mean, and that was actually a pretty spectacular piece of acting by Harrison Ford after he turned. Yeah. I think that scene in particular where he's like on that sheet rock. I don't know what he's laying on, but as he's trying to like fight the demons, the blood that's in him. But we'll talk about just how kind of it's a different term, because then we are for a minute like anti-Indiana Jones, right?
Yeah, and it's like, again, it's like the weird mythicalness of the movie where drinking the blood like turned him into a bad guy somehow. Like it doesn't really like explain that sort of stuff either, which is totally fine, because there was a time in movies where it was just like, we'll just believe it and that's fine. You know, it felt like he was hypnotized of some sort. And like you said, actually, that's a really good point. Keith hadn't really thought about like how good of an acting job that actually was, because he kind of stone-faced was like this villain for 10 minutes. Like it wasn't long before he gets burned and then snaps out of it type thing, but a lot of like crazy shit happens during that scene. And it's really cool, because it's like, again, he was presented as a superhero type character and then he kind of lost all control.
Yeah, it was honestly, it was scary. It was nerve-wracking to have him like that, because it's our main guy is bad, and so then it's like, how are we going to get him to turn
now?
Yeah. Yeah, seriously though, because it's Willie and it's Short Round after that. So we're like, how do we make this happen? But I am interested to talk about Willie and her role in this, because obviously in the first we have Marion, we have Karen Allen as Marion, and she is very, very resourceful and she can hold her own, where Willie is like the lounge singer who is just along for the ride because she is in the car with them. Chris, what's, you know, we've always talked about having a strong female lead besides a big, large character like Indiana Jones or whoever named the large actor we talked about. How do you feel about her participation in this, especially coming off of Raiders, where Karen Allen was so strong and so pivotal in that one?
Yeah, I think I definitely prefer Marion just as a character. It's interesting because it's just like, Willie is still kind of funny, and maybe that's what they're
hilarious
for. You know,
she was real funny.
She has some moments where she has to get involved with the story a bit. It feels like it's almost like the short round thing, where it's like they want to get him around people that are different or maybe further outside this, where he'll just have different interactions with this instead of how he did with Mary and some of the other people. And so it feels like they're like, well, not even necessarily give him a damsel in distress, because she only has like one real moment where she kind of feels like that. It just feels like, let's give him someone who's outside of this world, right, for him to play his jokes off of, or for, you know, sort of like a frame of reference for how insane some of the stuff that he's doing, just how crazy it is. And sometimes I don't always like characters like that, because it's just like, well, I can tell how crazy he is, or I can tell how dangerous this is. It's in a movie called Temple of Doom. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I get it. This is bad.
Yeah.
I'm on board. But again, I think it is redeemed by the fact that, like, she still feels like a character. Like, she still is funny. She still has, like, identifiable traits about, like, she has a life outside of this. You know what I mean? She ultimately just bumped into him in the club, right? Like, it's not like she was, you know, his lover who was just kind of following him around and just saying whatever. I think she got into arguments with him. She pushed back. Again, she got involved in the story in a couple things. I don't think she really like fought anybody or anything the same way that Marion does. I'm sure she didn't. I'm just blanking on it. But I don't know. It's a weird course. She's definitely my least favorite of the two, but it just feels so much like they just needed something. They just wanted a person for him to play off of.
Trying to be so different in every way.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and we've already got a character like that. Short Round is already kind of that character, even though he's more understanding of stuff Indiana Jones does, but that's the person who's like super different about than him, or super different than he is. Like, obviously, I know he's still going on the adventure, but he's like a little kid, so that is your frame of reference for how crazy this stuff is in comparison to, like you said, the almost superhero that he becomes. Like, when you see like a kid making these same jumps or in these same situations, you get an immediate understanding of how dangerous it was. So I don't know, she just feels like such a weird inclusion that, again, I still ended up liking, because she got enough to do for you, not be like, oh, she's a nothing burger character. Like, could they just not get Marion back in the movie? I'm confused. Like, she had stuff going on, but
yeah, Chris, I do agree. I think that with this, it's almost just because maybe, again, like a victim of her own success. So Karen Allen was so good and so strong that we needed somebody who we felt like maybe did need a little bit more help. And so then, like Cole, like you said several times already, we get that superhero aspect of it where he is saving the damsel in distress several times, whereas we felt like Karen Allen as Marion really didn't need to be saved.
Exactly.
Right? Like, she could fend for herself. So now we get another opportunity to make him a larger than life figure, where he is rescuing him and her, and then also a temple full of children too. So I think that maybe that's where it was. He just was a little bit too helpless at times, and just did the whole screaming bit several times, even though she did grab that snake and throw it in the jungle, which I was like, dude, I forgot how big that snake was. She was like, cut it out, and like threw it. And again, Harrison Ford is another great piece of acting. He's like terrified. He was up against that rock, you know, whenever he saw that it was a snake. But Cole, you talked about it earlier with the action bits and how it's just ramped up completely in this one. And again, like we talked about, outside of the opening scene, once we get to Pangkok Palace and we are in the depths of the temple, I think it's just action set piece after action set piece, right? It is the tribute to the, you know, we have the sacrifice, and then we have Indy getting caught, we have the children getting rescued, then the chase scene through the tunnels, which was, I thought that was actually a pretty cool little piece of coordination there, stunt coordination and all that.
Oh, that shit rocked, man.
Oh, yeah. Just bang,
that's the man. That's the thing about it. Like, all of the action sequences were amazing. They were just so packed in. It was honestly like, if you were to tell me, if we hear one day Michael Bay in an interview is like, yeah, I saw that and I just made my career that, where I was just going to be ridiculously fast paced and just put action sequence after action sequence. And that sounds like I'm giving it a bad review. I'm not. It's just so different. It's so different than what we had seen in the first one, and why I love the first one and the third one so much. So it is curious that, like, that those are the things that survived it. It was like, okay, cool. We're just going to do, you know, they love the action sequences. Well, here you fucking go.
Yeah, and it just felt like if we found out, you know, some year, and I know it's been years since this came out, but like Michael Bay says, like, yeah, I got my break, my big break on Temple of Doom. I was an intern on set, and so I would just give it to
you, son of a bitch. Ideas. Yeah, yep.
He was like, yeah, I was an intern there, and so that was really my first studio gig after driving this Daisy for almost blinded Judy Dench. But
he taught Steven Spielberg about drones in 1984.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg's like, what's that? What are you talking about? He's like, dude,
it's gonna be big.
He's like, listen, man, just whenever you hear it, just know it's gonna come around and be a big thing. But I think that, you know, obviously we talked about the having some villains and having some good or bad villains, and having Mola Ram as our main. And it's odd because I feel like there really isn't, like, just like in the first, we didn't have, like, it was just like the Nazis, they're all bad. And
so Nazis were the bad guys, yeah.
Yeah, we have more of a focal point in Mola Ram and how he is doing all the sacrifices. He's ripping out the hearts. He's commanding, you know, he's trying to steal.
But we really don't know what he's doing, though.
No.
they just keep putting these action things, and, like, we don't really know why he's ripping hearts out, you know.
Yeah, just making, like, are the sacrifices to help them find the other two stones, or what is it?
We don't really get any context, you know. We know, though, like, the thing about it is it almost assigned this secret cult the same kind of street cred that Nazis have. This is so stupid to say, but, like, we just assume that all the Nazis, it didn't matter what they were doing, it was bad. We talked about how that worked perfectly for the first one, right? It was just
because we know they don't
need motivation. We know Nazis suck, and maybe we're supposed to be working under the assumption that they would do some savage shit because they're, you know, this secret cult. But they never really tell us what it is that he's doing, or why we, like, what are the motivations behind what's happening? We don't really know.
Yeah, and at the dinner, we do have Indiana talking to Lal about the thuggy cold and for sure. Yeah, so we do get a little bit of that, but by the time we get into the depths of the temple, it's kind of forgotten about. So then we get in there.
Like, they don't really tell us what he's doing, I guess.
Right. Yeah, no. But outside of, and yeah, I think with that, you're right, with that being the first scene that we do see that particular cult, and they're making that sacrifice, I think it is just to let us know, like, hey, these are some bad dudes, and they're making a live human sacrifice to Kali, or what, you know, trying to, even though we don't really get a, hey, they're doing this to help find the other stones, but really the child labor is to find the other stones. So they're just in there just making a sacrifice just for the sake, just because they're just that evil.
Right.
And they're making a sacrifice. But I think it's up to the audience to kind of decipher that, you know, because I think at that point we're just all kind of making our own assumptions about what they're doing. And we know they're bad because they are making a literally live human sacrifice. But yeah, Carl, I agree. At that point, we're kind of trying to piece some things together. Because we're like, you know, who is this guy? Why is he ripping his heart out? Stuff like that. And so it does bring about some questions. But I think at that point, the movies, it's a whirlwind, man. Like, we're there. Yeah,
you're just fucking going, dude.
Evil Indy. They're fighting below there now. Like, Indy turns. And then we, you know, because Willie's about to get sacrificed. Like, there's just so many things going on. And then we get the children being freed. The tunnel escape. The bridge scene, which was incredible. I just forgot how harrowing that particular scene was, especially whenever Indiana literally cut the bridge in half. Like, he just he cuts it in half and they're all hanging on.
He yells out to Kiwi and he's like, shit, and starts, like, wrapping his arm around it. knew he was about to some bullshit.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Whenever he's like, and, you know, him and, or her, yeah, Short Round and Willie both having to, like, tie their hands and feet. I mean, one of them would have fallen, right? Like, as hard as that bridge hit the side of that wall or the side of that rock, I feel like, I mean, they got some incredible, like, at some point, I wouldn't be surprised if Indiana was like, damn, you strong. Like, whenever they didn't fall off.
Yeah.
They didn't fall off the bridge. But, it is just, I think it is packed in, and maybe just the second, it's hard to call that the second act of the movie, because by that point, it's like the fourth or fifth act. But
it's really just like one and three. There really is no second act. Like, it's just, wow. Yeah,
like it's like a slow play. We're in India, and then bam, like once we're in Pangkok Palace, and that the one assassin or the guy tries to kill Indiana, then we're like, we are off to the races, buddy. We're stepping over roaches, and we're reaching through all this stuff. We're about to get crushed in this temple, and so I think that it is. There's just a lot going on. Was the pacing good for you, Chris? Do you feel like it's like Cole talked about with all the action sequences? Was it trying to keep the audience connected? And then the audience had a chance to connect.
But they didn't, right?
Yeah, no,
the audience was like, Damien, cut! Damien, cut!
Hey, Damien!
that's the audience in this one.
That was the audience, yeah. They were definitely like,
you do back.
But how do you feel about the pacing of this one, especially in comparison to the first one, Chris?
It felt a little fast, I will say. And again, it's like you said, it's another movie that gets you out in under 2 hours. I guess, like, you know, it's still like an hour 55. And it just has so many action sequences. It feels like everything is just kind of like a setup to get you to the next one. And again, that kind of makes what Cole was saying about the tribe. The bad guys, you know, that just makes it a bit more glaring that we don't really know anything about. That's what I was saying. Like, it feels like they kind of just told us they're the bad guys, and then for good measure, just they're like, they're doing child slavery, by the way. Like, that was supposed to just sell us on. So there's little stuff like that, you know what I mean? There's like, obviously it'd make the movie longer to even just have like a short conversation telling us what they're up to. But it just feels kind of as if there's just like some additional information that, you know, I think would have benefited from. Again, it would have made it longer. I mean, there's something that you could have cut. And I think that does have a lot to do with the sort of the spontaneous nature of the film. Maybe that's what they're going for. Maybe they're kind of going for this sense of, you know, once stuff starts happening, it just keeps happening. Because again, he escapes the nightclub thing, and then he's on a plane that crashes, and then like it just all spirals from there. So maybe you were supposed to feel this kind of breakneck pace. But it's one of those cases where, like, but it tries to do stuff outside of just the action scene. Not a lot, but those try to do a couple things outside of that, and it makes sort of how they're kind of glossed over and how you're rushed into the next thing like a bit more clear. Like, by the time we get to the bridge scene, I do love it, but like it almost feels like
you're a little out of breath.
A hat on a hat on a hat on top of another hat scenario. We can't do it. Yeah, because just like you go through the thrill, like, you know, minecart sequence. That scene is like very fun and like
amazing.
Have like a moment of
maybe one of the best scenes in the whole series.
Seriously, it's incredible.
Honestly, it's awesome. They blow
it's incredibly hot.
Like the first bit of CGI ever, it looked like.
Yeah, they invented CGI, dude.
Blew up off, like, this feels like on that set,
Michael Bay. I'm starting to believe Keith. Like, I'm starting to believe Keith. Intern Michael Bay. He's like, y'all are gonna love this shit.
Yeah, y'all watch this. There's an explosion for no reason.
Yeah, a couple times actually.
The raft blew up or whatever, and they got out of the water.
Yeah. The whole lake blows up
for no reason.
There's a trolley running through the city for some reason. It's like, what
ding,
the fuck?
Ding, ding,
this,
ding,
is the
ding, ding.
This is the desert, motherfucker.
Yeah. Like, somebody go tell that intern that we're in 1936 and we can't have trolleys in the middle of a tribe's village. He was like, what if we had a monorail, like a speed rail down in the bottom of this temple? They're like, it's 1936, Mike. We can't do that, man.
Like, Mike, we can't do that shit.
Yeah.
Just anywhere yet. What are you talking about?
Nobody wanted to hear him out. Now he's like, look, they called me a madman.
Yeah.
know, the formula.
Spielberg called him, and Spielberg called him in like 19. He's like, "Mike, it's Steve. What's up, buddy?" He's like, "Hey, I got this idea." And he's like, "You couldn't live with your failures. What'd that bring you?"
Yeah, what'd back that to bring me. He's like, "You son of a bitch, you were right."
He's like, "I tried to tell you in 84 and you didn't want to listen. Now look at me. Now look at you.
I tried to tell you in 84. Do you imagine that, remembering something for that long? Like, I tried to tell you. I tried to tell you in 84. I
tried to tell you on the set.
Man, I'll tell you what, though. That's what, like, successful people remember shit like that, though.
Oh,
so,
my
like,
God.
I wouldn't, if, like, that would be, that would legit, if that actually happened, he would definitely remember it and be like, "I told you, Spielberg, you dumb motherfucker."
I'm telling you, Chris.
That's what crazy successful people do.
Chris, you remember season 3 of Chappelle when he went around, he had that list of people that he was going to go after he got famous?
Yeah. Yep.
And he's like, "Casting extraordinaire." He went to that casting lady's. He went to her agency or whatever, and he's like, "You said I didn't have quote it." He's like, "Man, was that bitch wrong?" He had Spike Lee on there, and he's like, "And she called me a nigga on the set of Jungle Fever." He's like, "Twice," and they did like a little hand thing.
The way he fights is like so deadpan, looking at the camera as he says it all
twice.
He was like, I'm like, he didn't even make that up. He's like, that's a real thing that happened to Spike.
Yeah, that actually happened.
Like, that guy's a good actor, but it's just really awful.
Bro just casually brought Spike Lee in for a skit, and he said, "Hey, I need you. I got this idea. I need you to help me out, Spike." And Spike was like, "No problem, Dave Chappelle."
Yeah.
Bro went to that comedy club, and dude was in a wheelchair. He's like, "Thank you, thank you for making it that much sweeter, you son of a bitch." And he's like, "I was gonna burn this place down. You don't smell all that gas."
You don't smell all that gas.
Dude, I hear my brothers say that shit all the time. "I was gonna burn this place down. You don't smell that gas."
You don't smell that gas.
That was like the funniest thing you ever heard. There's not like a 3-year shirt that guy's just like our favorite inside joke. We just say that shit for any reason.
It's always funny when people use jokes like that out of context, but it still works. I had a friend. She I don't know if it was her or her friends, but she coined the phrase. She used "fuck your couch" instead of like "screw you," basically. And it was the best insertion of a phrase of all time. She was talking about like a coworker who was talking trash about her. She was like, "What? Fuck your couch." And then she just like talking
about "fuck your couch."
Yeah, it's incredible. Incredible, man. Like any scenario can be
used. My legs.
What am I going to do with these
things? Get another couch.
What am I going to do about my legs?
What am I going to do with all these roaches, Steven Spielberg?
Yeah.
Had all those bugs on her. She actually did have over 2,000 bugs, the actress who played Willie. She had over 2,000 bugs. Kate Capshaw.
Mm-hmm.
She had to take a bunch of sedatives before the scene because she was like, they're actually
bugs. That's 80s, bro.
Bro. Just like Alfred Molina had a bunch of literally had tarantulas on his back, just like that, dude. Just a bunch of bugs. Right when she was reaching in to pull that lever, and that one like millipede was crawling in her hair. I was like, "Bro, stop this shit right now!"
Yeah, please. She was like, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't really like bugs." They're like, "Try Ambien."
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Like, we've got anybody got Quaaludes? Or
Michael
Quaaludes
Bay
on the set? Yeah,
Michael Bay
yeah,
was like, "I got them." He's like, I'll give her some lewds if you put in one explosion in this scene." And they were like,
"God,
fine, we'll make the plane explode, Mike." Shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just give us the lewds.
He was persistent with it.
He was.
Yeah.
"They call me a madman. I'm telling you, man.
Motherfucker, that was 40 years ago.
They called me a madman.
That was weeks ago, motherfucker. I'm partying.
I told you that 40 years ago.
I tried to tell you in 1984.
In 1984, man, remember we were in Calcutta? We were about to go do the temple scene, and you said that we didn't need any explosions. Oh, man. I don't even know how he saw. Oh, yeah, the Michael Bay thing. That's right. Was, yeah. I don't know.
Michael Bay, yeah.
Listen, I'm going to do a deep dive, man. I'm going to find out that he was somehow.
Let me get to the bottom of this shit.
I'm telling you, man, I've got to find out now. He was somehow, maybe his nephew was on set or something. I don't know. We're going to figure this out, though. Yeah, I know what it was. His nephew was a key grip. That's exactly what it was. He was the stunt double for Harrison Ford, but also the key grip. Actually, the stunt double for Harrison Ford, actually, he did have to play a large role because the scene where Indiana gets attacked right after dinner, Harrison Ford had a herniated disc in his back after that, so the stunt double had to play a much larger role in this because of that. But at the time, apparently, he was built and looked very similar to Harrison Ford, so it was pretty seamless, apparently. Well, imagine looking like Harrison Ford in 84. I bet that dude fucking cleaned up.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, yeah, he fucked, I'm for sure.
No, no doubt.
My ass off.
Yeah.
That's you, point blank, you Harrison Ford, huh?
Yes. Yes, I am. What are they going to do, Google you? Fuck, they can't Google. Like, you know what I'm saying? What are they going to do? Look you up? By the time they figure this shit out, man, it's going to be 93.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? The best move is to ass fucking Michael Bay.
Not just say about time shit out, it's gonna be 93.
It is, man. I'm telling
you. He's right, man. By the time they get to the bottom of that shit,
they're gonna be like, shit, remember when we were at the China Club and I gave that Harrison Ford my number? It wasn't even fucking Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
It was Rick Dalton.
Yeah, it was Rick Dalton.
That is the best acting I have ever seen.
Ever seen.
He's like Rick fucking Dalton.
Rick fucking Dalton.
Man. All right. Category. Sorry. Way off track here. That's my bad, man. That's my bad. But laugh out loud. Like we're talking about, this movie is oddly funny. Had a lot of opportunities to really make. I mean, Indiana just on his own, just his comedic timing was really good. His deadpan delivery on some stuff, that was great. But the first one I had two. One where Indiana, like right after he was under his trance, and then Short Round got him out of it, and those henchmen were coming at him near the pit, and then one guy had like the long stick and just like kind of Indiana's kind of pole vaulted him into the pit. I was like,
yeah,
like, I never stood a chance. But the one that the argument between Indiana and Willie as she is trying to free them from getting impaled and smashed at the same time, and he's like, your other right, you know, like she reaches in that one hole and he reaches through there. He's like,
grabs
right.
Her hand. Yeah.
Yeah. All of that. There's that back and forth between them as they are about to get crushed. It was just hilarious to me. So those two scenes had me laughing. Cole, what'd you have?
Man, I like at the end when Willie was like, I'm going back to Missouri where they don't eat snakes and they don't like rip somebody's heart out or something. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
So it's something along those lines. But by the end of it, it was just like she also just snapped. She was like cool, calm, and then just lost her shit on him right at the end, like just reverted back. But yeah, she said, I'll have to pull it up, but was like, I can't wait to get back to Missouri where they don't eat snakes and because something else. So that one
I don't
got
blame
me.
Her, though. Not at all. Chris, what had you laughing?
Early on in the movie, every time when Willie would say something in Indiana, she would just call him Mr. whatever, and Short Round kept yelling at her, you call him Mr. Jones. And you just tell him that. I don't know why.
She said, that's Dr. Jones, doll. That's what he said.
Dr. Jones is what I have for you, don't you? It'd be funny because, like, the cut to him would be so, like, it was like a cut from the Godfather. It was so aggressive, like, it would cut to him, like, he'd be yelling louder than any person you'd ever seen. Like, he just had, like, this full of aggression. And it's this little kid saying, you call him Dr. Jones. Like, you thought he was a fucking drill sergeant the way that he was looking when they did that. So that one was funny. I don't know if this is a fever dream, if I'm not remembering this one. I feel like I didn't see it this time, but the first time I watched this one 2 weeks ago, when he's fighting, I guess, someone from the cult, and they're like, they've got the sword or whatever, and they're like spinning it around or something like that. I don't know if I'm making this over to the next one, like someone like doing something with the sword and like it feels like it's the bit from Raiders, like he reaches where he thinks
oh,
like
yeah, and the gun's not there.
Yeah, but it gets the bridge.
I don't know if that's an episode.
Yeah, it's right before they get on the bridge.
It's on the bridge. Yeah. Okay, just making sure. Yeah.
Okay, which was hilarious. That was a nice callback. Like, and actually,
this, but I remember seeing when I. Yeah, I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, I did put that in my notes because like that's a nice little callback to that because he reached for his holster and it was empty. Clearly, it had fallen out or something during the 53 scene before that particular part.
Yeah.
Still hilarious though.
Probably got shit out in there on the fucking minecart. It's just so funny because like that was a thing that was originally even in the first script. That was like an improvised thing. Like it became like a lasting piece of. Just it becomes something you'd make a callback to, so that was just funny.
Yeah.
And then what Cole mentioned when Willie goes off, and that was what I had my review for the first, and that was my quote that I put in there. I should have pulled it up too. But yes, she was just like when they feed you snakes and rip your heart out and drop you in the fire pit.
Yeah.
So they don't do all that. It's the line in this movie. I'm going back to Missouri. There's just shit in this movie that's just so funny to me. Just the line. I'm going back to Missouri being in an Indiana Jones movie is just funny for reasons I can't explain.
Just all for all the states, like that one to be named is really funny to me.
Yeah. And like, honestly, Missouri ain't that much better.
Right. So, yeah, just like kidding. What she's just talking kidding. About, like she's complaining about all this and then she wants to go back to SEMO or something. Like, where's she going? Like,
yeah. Last time I ate snakes was in Missouri.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. You were there.
Yeah.
We got anaconda bread.
This water moccasin this water moccasin souffle is delicious.
Yeah.
Goddamn, man.
Unleaded.
The zoo tailgate.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Mustang. So this is just an absolute random appearance, but it's Dan Aykroyd Weber. He showed
he sure
up.
Sure was, man.
He gave
Dan
him
Aykroyd.
Yeah, he got him on the plane, like Lau Shay's plane before they took off. He was telling him about their, you know, he's like telling him about the plane and all that. It was a quick scene. And it was, excuse me, it's real weird. It's the same year that Ghostbusters came out, but obviously he had been in SNL and other things prior to that. So it was a really random role for him. But my Mr. Mustang was Dan Aykroyd as Weber. Cole, who'd you have?
I'm going to go with Roy Chico as Lau Shay. I thought he was he cooked, man. He was a very Bond villain-esque. He's also in Bloodsport. I really like Roy Chico. So
I like it. Chris, Mr. Mustang.
I also love Dan Aykroyd because it just blew my mind.
It's so weird that he's in this movie.
The very first time. Yeah. It wasn't until like, I watched it again that I was just like, and maybe Ghostbusters is like on the mind because that new one is out. I haven't seen it, but the promotion's everywhere. So it's just like when he comes on screen again, like I'm like more focused. I'm like, that fucking Dan Aykroyd. I was like, I did not notice that the first time I watched this.
Well, he's doing an accent too, so it's not even like, you know, we can pick up on the Dan, because when Dan Aykroyd talks, it's like, that's Dan Aykroyd, but he's doing like a British English accent in there.
Right.
Real strange. I don't know why he went with that. But anyway, it was extremely random. Was with
why
Dan Aykroyd,
go with that verse?
Also my Mustang. All right, so for the Diesel, no surprise, the actor's name is Amrish Puri. That's Malu Ram. Just a terrible person, ripping out hearts. He's got child labor going on. He had red painted on the top of his head for some reason, man. He just made a whole bunch of terrible decisions. So that's my Diesel. Cole, who'd you have?
Same. I don't think. I mean, I guess I could say Nazis again, but they're not really in this one. So I'm going with you on that, Keith.
There you go. Chris.
But still, fuck Nazis.
We can always blame stuff on them. I'm sure they're involved.
Yeah, for the record.
All right, Chris, who'd you have for your Diesel?
Same person though, Malu Ram, you know, running the court, they're kidnapping kids, he's ripping people's hearts out, you know. Bad dude.
Yeah. Just that's three strikes.
You know what I mean? You gotta make sure to throw in the kidnapping kid. If I said he's ripping people's hearts out, you're just like,
yeah, that's right, kinda cool.
Baller, though. Like,
yeah, why is he why can he like, do that? Yeah. Thomas Cool is a throat rip. Like,
yeah.
Honestly, yeah. And then you're just like, oh man, he's kidnapping kids and a slave. You're like, ooh, a bad heart rip out move. Not so good now.
Like, and he didn't pay his taxes, so he has to take a bus to work.
Yeah. plagiarizes cookbook.
Everyone knows he plagiarizes cookbook. Dude, that shit is so. Because how the fuck do you think of something like that?
It's terrible. I just
to write that down in the script. Like, what the fuck?
Plagiarize a cookbook. That means somebody has done it and got called out on it, and they were like, I've got to put this joke in the movie.
Oh, what? They know someone who did that.
100%.
Has your mom plagiarized her cookbook.
Plagiarized her cookbook. Yeah, bro.
She stole the anaconda bread.
That's hilarious. Yeah. Everybody knows it's not your family's recipe on anaconda bread.
Yep.
You use sharp cheddar instead of... Anyway. So for Rinse Due, I went with Q Kwan, Short Round. He was incredible. I had a bunch of scenes where he had to be either the focal point or go toe-to-toe with Indiana or really anybody else, and he stood his ground and cooked in a lot of scenes, if not every scene that he was in. So that was mine. Cole, who'd you have?
Man, we're on the same page. Kiwi Kwan, man. He was so good in this. And like, incredible. What is interesting about this is I do feel like Harrison Ford was finally, well, not finally, but really figured out what he wanted Indiana Jones to be in this and was outstanding, but still the scene was stolen by Kiwi Kwan. So gotta go with him.
Love that we're spending the block on him and he's getting his roses. Like you talked about, Everything Everywhere All at Once. He's in the latest season of Loki and he crushes in that too. And he's got some other projects coming up. So man, I'm extremely happy for him.
And Chris, he won an Oscar before Harrison Ford. So there you go.
He sure did. That's wild. Wild.
He becomes a teacher. Same person for me though. Okay. Oh God, sorry. I agree with you, Cole. It's like it really seemed like Harrison Ford came into his own as a character. And it's weird because, like, for all the things that we were talking about that maybe didn't work or some weird misses, like, that character is just so good. He still holds it all together. He does a great job at it. Again, he has to interact with a lot of people. But Kenny Kwan just did just a fantastic job being, like, a child. You know, he played the perfect version of just a different look at a person who's accompanying Indiana Jones on these adventures for him to kind of play off of. And I think he just did, you know, it's weird to think that they would go like, yeah, let's add a kid in there to a character this much like Mystique already. And that's just this popular with an actor this big. Cause like you said, it's easy for adults to get in this matchup and just lose and just get blown away. Especially again, maybe the hindsight was different, or not hindsight. Maybe it was different because Indiana Jones only exists for 3 years. So maybe it wasn't, you know, he wasn't so much larger than life at that point. But it's still Harrison Ford. It's still a character who, you know, was pretty big from that last movie. So to bring about a kid and just like, hey, you're in this movie now. Tough gig. I thought he did a fantastic job.
In his film debut.
It's nice that he's finally getting his flowers. Man. Yeah, oh, yeah. Also that, yeah, in his film debut. Had not did a, you know, this was just the very first one. Like, hey, we're putting you in the most popular franchise right now. It's not Star Wars or Alien or Predator. And you're just going to play like 1A, 1B with the biggest actor on Earth. Is that okay? Is that okay? Is that
good luck. With you? Yeah. He's like, okay, cool. No problem. What do you need me to do? You need me to drive? You need me to, whatever you need me to do, I'll do it. I mean, shit, he got Indy out of that trance, man. Indy was ready to. Indy was ready to cook him, you know? He got him out of the trance. I'm telling you, man, he was important.
He lit him on fire a little bit, but, you know.
Yeah, he did. It's Hollywood, man. You got to light your fans on fire.
Everybody gets burned every once in a while.
Yeah. All right, so for best scene, I actually went with the scene where Indiana and Short Round are both fighting. So Short Round's fighting the Maharaja, and Indy's fighting one of the henchmen from the cult. And just the camera work as we see Indy and Short Round throwing the same punches and combos, I thought that was really neat. Just kind of showed, you know, them spending a lot of time together and just the reverence that the Short Round had for Indiana throughout the course of their time together. So I thought that was a really awesome scene. So that was my best scene. Cole.
I got to go with the railway car escape, man. That fucking rules. Like, not only was that super cool, I always, as a kid, wished that that was a ride at a fucking amusement park because it just looked like so much fucking fun, you know?
Yeah.
And just like all of the way it worked, that sort of stuff. And like now that I see it as an adult, it's a little less like, it's not as mind blowing because you can see it a couple times, like the Kiwi Kwan is a fucking doll and stuff like that, which is fine. It still looks dope. Still, you know, a lot of it was practical. And it was fantastic, man. So I one of those scenes that like I loved. And like I said earlier, maybe the best that they've done. So
no, they cooked. Chris, best scene.
I went with the opening, man. It was awesome. Like I said, it threw me off so much because it just wasn't anything I'd ever expect to see Indiana Jones do. But I think that's what made it fun, right? Like you can't, you know, I think that's one of the one places where I'm okay with them making a change and not going back to the well and doing, you know, another opener. He's looking for another artifact, you know, like even Bond, when they do their cold opens, no two are the same. You know, it's never the same type of mission, the same type of environment. So I think it's good to, you know, mix it up like that. And again, it was fun seeing him in a different scenario, seeing how he would get out of without his whip or without the ability to just, he still does some crazy acrobatic type shit like Indiana Jones, but you know, he can't do the same stuff he normally does, right? He's not trying to outrun stuff. He's not able to use the environment the same way to kind of deal with everybody. But again, like a lot of the same Indiana Jones stuff still shines through, you know, his charisma and the way that he's, his fighting, like if they said that he was a trained fighter, I wouldn't believe him. Like he's kind of just a guy that throws right hooks.
A brawler.
That's his fighting style. He's just a guy spamming the square button. And like, you know what? It's worked. It hasn't failed him yet. but it's really fun, man. It's just such a fun sequence. Like I said, I don't want to call him a fish out of water because, again, he just lives in the real world more often than not. But again, that's just not where I think to see him at. So getting to see him like that was awesome.
No, it was really good. That was a phenomenal opening scene. Again, the opening scenes are just as important as a Bond movie scene, I feel like, when it comes to Indiana Jones. So they both landed. Obviously, the first two landed, and we'll get to the third eventually. But yeah, so that was a really good scene. I really like how it opened. I mean, it was like right out of the gates, we're in it, and let's go. All right, Cole, awards. What'd you see?
Nominated for best score, one for best visual effects. Yeah, that all makes sense to me.
Yeah, same. Trivia, you guys find anything interesting?
Besides, I didn't get much, man. Yeah.
Is banned you in named India?
Some of the cool stuff out.
Yeah, I didn't see a ton outside of the herniated disc and the stunt double. And again, this being banned in India was a big one too.
Like these feel kind of weird though, like we don't stumble into as much trivia. Like they're always all like the cool things, like with the improv and stuff like that. Some of the other things we've bumped into, but even like the last Crusade when I've looked at it down, so there isn't a lot of the, you know, there aren't just like pages of just the most odd trivia on these movies. And I don't know if it's just, you know, at the time it was hard to document this, or maybe a lot of people don't remember that, but it's kind of like you would think that these movies have tons of, you know, behind the scenes stuff that would just get shared or come out as time went on. And I'm sure there is some out there, but in the usual places I look, I don't see anything. I think that's strange for these movies. They're just so popular.
Right. I thought there'd be a little bit more, but there's not a ton outside of course, the Michael Bay stuff with him being an intern on this movie, but
yeah, I did forget to. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to get to, but yeah, everybody can go check out Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, 1984. It is on Disney Plus. But Chris, we are
and
back.
And Paramount Plus.
Oh, is it on Paramount? Okay, bet. Yeah,
you
Paramount.
Can watch both. Do it wherever you want.
Yeah, do a split screen. Watch both of them.
Just like, time them up correctly.
Do like YouTube TV and just have the four squares in one.
There you go. Watch four of them are
Paramount, Disney. Yeah. Then have the director's commentary. All right, Chris, background to your pick. What are we watching next?
Well, you know, you can stay on either Disney Plus or Paramount Plus, and you can also, you know, type in the same first two words and find the next movie. We're going to do Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You know, I've just kind of run through these. Let's just go ahead and knock them out and talk about them, you know, so I can blow your minds again on, you know.
I'm going to have the exact same reaction.
First time seeing these movies. I can't talk about different rules.
Let's
put Sean Connery in this one.
Oh, yeah. They were like, you know what? We're going to do a lot of Bond stuff. What's the best thing we can do next? Put fucking Bond in it.
I know.
Yeah.
Like an ace in the hole, man. Just bring out Sean Connery. That's some good shit right there. That Spielberg guy, he may know what he's doing. I don't know.
If only said, oh my God, we have to ask someone to take on the impossible task of being Indiana Jones's dad. Who could do that?
I don't know. Yeah. Sean Connery?
You know how hard that probably was, though? If someone thinks about it, they'd be like, hey, man, you have to put Indiana Jones's dad in the next movie. We cannot fuck this up. I'd be like, if I was a casting director, I'd be like, yeah, man, I quit, actually. Good luck with that.
Yeah, y'all have fun.
They're like, is Cary Grant still around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Humphrey Bogart still doing anything?
Talk about it. I can't wait to talk about it because I have thoughts, but just picture this. What if Connery said no?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah. They just don't make the movie. They're just like, all right, cool. Yeah.
And think about
we get Tommy Lee Jones somehow, but he's older.
Tommy Lee Jones can do it, even though I'm pretty sure he's the same age as Harrison Ford. Right, let's go. Yeah.
Yeah. I would be down for it. Either that or Josh Brolin.
Who's not even born yet.
Yeah, he's doing the Goonies. He was a teenager in the Goonies in 84, so he's okay. He may be all right.
He was nine.
Yeah, I think
his dad is younger.
Have some of that aging technology that Scorsese has been using. All right, everybody, you know what to do. So first we're watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom on Paramount and or Disney Plus. And then we're staying on Paramount and or Disney Plus, and we're doing The Last Crusade. But for all of us here at the Stream Team, Keith Evans, Camilla, Chris Lowry, I'm going back to Missouri.
Yeah, I ain't eating no more damn snakes.
No more snakes.